Thanks for listening to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. This is David Gottlieb. My guest today is William Kohlbrenner, professor of English at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Professor Kohlbrenner is author of The Last Rabbi, Joseph Soloveitchik and Talmudic Tradition, published by Indiana University Press. In this book, Professor Kohlbrenner plumbs the depths of Rav Soloveitchik's work as both a towering Talmudic scholar and a philosopher of great depth and nuance. Using a methodology that both honors and encompasses the breadth of Soloveitchik's erudition and experience, Professor Kohlbrenner consults literary and psychoanalytic theory to create a portrait of Soloveitchik and of rabbinic tradition that bridges the chasms and calamities of 20th century Jewish life and thought. William Kohlbrenner joins me today to discuss his book. Professor Kohlbrenner, thanks so much for being with me.
Delighted to be here, David.
And I'm very glad to hear your grandchildren in the background, and trust me, we'll all be very jealous of that. So no worries.
I'm glad.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, if you would, your background, your education and interests, and how you came to be interested in Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Well, I mean, first, I should probably say that my profile is not exactly the classic profile of a Jewish studies scholar. My PhD is in English literature, and I did that PhD in the 80s at Columbia on John Milton. Milton, of course, is best known for his epic poem Paradise Lost, but the work that really most compelled me as a graduate student was his 1644 tract against censorship called Areopagitica. What interested me about the work especially was the way in which he conceived of a conception of community while maintaining also an idea of pluralism. That idea fascinated me not only as a Miltonist, but being at Columbia in the 80s, where theory and literary and cultural criticism were urgent matters. Mm-hmm. I was also interested in pluralism as a kind of theoretical principle. On the way, I discovered Rabbi Soloveitchik's work. And I should say that really still today, more than any other thinker in the Jewish tradition, Rabbi Soloveitchik engaged me because he spoke the languages which I speak. Meaning, obviously, he's an expert in the traditions of Western philosophy. And really, through his work, I was able to engage with and discover rabbinic texts in a way in which I certainly wouldn't have been able to otherwise. That is, I think Soloveitchik provides a kind of theoretical language to discuss issues that remain always implicit in the Talmud. That there are certain conceptions, for example, of pluralism in Talmudic languages that Soloveitchik articulates through the languages of whether it's quantum physics or religious philosophy, that others only kind of act or practice. For Soloveitchik, there was not only the practice, but also the articulation of the methodological foundations of those discourses. Uh-huh. So really, I traveled that unusual path from Milton to Soloveitchik. I think as a literary critic, my current work, that is The Last Rabbi, is able to address issues in Soloveitchik's work, which perhaps some of his students were not able to address, simply because their languages were mostly the languages of Jewish thought, Jewish philosophy, and rabbinics.
Uh-huh. So that raises a two-part question. One is for listeners who may not be familiar with Soloveitchik's biography, tell us what made him unique as a 20th century Talmudist and thinker, or indeed a Talmudist and thinker of any age. And the second part of the question is, why is the title of the book The Last Rabbi?
Well, Soloveitchik came from perhaps the greatest family, rabbinic family of the 19th to 20th century, that is the Brisk family, Soloveitchik family. And his father really wanted Soloveitchik to dedicate his life as his ancestors had. Those include the Gaon of Vilna and Chaim of Volozhin, to continue in a world of Talmud and rabbinics. His mother, however, was successful in getting the young Joseph to take a different turn, and he went to the University of Berlin and studied philosophy. So Soloveitchik became an expert in both the languages of Jewish thought and also in philosophy, which was obviously, for in his age, extremely unusual. He came to America in 1929 and established a community in Boston, and really from that community in Boston and then continuing in his life as really the foundation or the intellectual foundation of Yeshiva University, he really created a new version of Orthodoxy in America that is modern Orthodoxy, which, as you said in the introduction, really bridges the gap between religious and philosophical languages, between the world of really the world of the shtetl and the world of the university. You can really see in Soloveitchik's early writings in the late 20s when he first comes to Boston that he's trying to really balance those different influences in his life and in his community. And he is really successful, especially obviously in his own life, in maintaining the rigors of Jewish thought and also incorporating the open or more open world of the university. Uh-huh. Now, as for the title of The Last Rabbi, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of England, describes Soloveitchik really as being the first rabbi. That is, after the Shoah, after the Holocaust, Soloveitchik is one of the first rabbis to come to America, and as I said, to found a distinctly American version of Orthodoxy. In that sense, I don't disagree with Sacks. Soloveitchik is, in some sense, the first rabbi. But in other ways, Soloveitchik's emphasis or his own self-creation, his own really idiosyncratic development. Soloveitchik says at the beginning of his most canonical work, Halachic Man, that the most important gift that Judaism gave to the world was the emphasis on creativity. And Soloveitchik really emphasizes in his own writing, in his own kind of self-creation. And he really creates himself. In the late 1950s, he wrote, I think somewhat despairingly, that he had failed as a rabbi in Israel, which is quite extraordinary, actually, because he probably gave rabbinic ordination to more people than any other rabbi, certainly in America, that people say about 2,000. But he conceived of himself as a failure as a rabbi, a failure as a teacher in Israel, because as he wrote, he was unable to convey what he calls the Torah of the heart. Soloveitchik's work, on the one hand, is immensely analytical, Talmudic, detailed. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's another side of his work, which is full of emotion, exploration, explorations of the psyche. And, of course, the former he was able to convey to his many, many Talmudim, to his many, many students. Mm-hmm. But the latter, he felt, at least, less so. And I've spoken to many of his students, and they've objected to the title and said, of course, it wasn't like that. But I'm primarily interested in my book in Soloveitchik's own self-representation. In some sense, he felt that he was a failure and was and did fail to convey a certain aspect of his teaching, a certain aspect of his Torah.
It's interesting because you paint a very nuanced picture of Soloveitchik as a conflicted, lonely, melancholy man, someone drawn to and repelled by the world of halachic epistemology, especially its masculine aspects. And you take a very interesting approach consulting Freudian thought. And I wonder what in Soloveitchik's work, in his biography, and perhaps in your own, led you to this approach to Soloveitchik's work?
I guess I'll start with the last part of your question. And I had started out thinking that I would write a book about the continuity between Talmudic epistemology and hermeneutics, and Soloveitchik's epistemology and hermeneutics. That is, I had been writing articles about Talmudic epistemology, the nature of Talmudic dispute, and I had also been, as I said at the outset of our talk, the nature of Soloveitchik's conception of pluralism. I realized as I was putting the work together that there was not so much a continuity between Talmudic conceptions of pluralism and Soloveitchik's conception of pluralism, but actually a rupture. And I, as you mentioned, turned to Freud's work. I remember rereading Freud's 1915 essay, Mourning and Melancholy, while I was preparing or in the process of writing The Last Rabbi, and found that Freud's conception of mourning was appropriate to the rabbinic conception of interpretation. That is, for the rabbis, there is what I call a kind of hermeneutics of mourning. Uh-huh. At the beginning of every hermeneutic endeavor, I think for the rabbis, there's a sense of loss and a lack of knowledge. And that lack is recuperated or somehow accommodated through the process of interpretation. And out of that conception of the hermeneutics of mourning. For Freud, mourning means simultaneously going back to the past and going forward into the future. For the rabbis, there's the attempt to go back into the past, but also to move into the future, a future of multiple interpretations. For Soloveitchik, by contrast, it wasn't so much the healthy version of mourning which Freud describes, but rather the unhealthy version of mourning, the sense that loss becomes so overwhelming that one needs a kind of compensation for that loss. So Soloveitchik, I think, feels a tremendous sense of the loss of some kind of essential wholeness. And here I think Soloveitchik is more drawn to some conception of being, of ontology, the desire for some union. And because he can't have that, there is the need for a compensation of the law to which Soloveitchik always has an ambivalent relationship. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. Freud and Freudian thinkers have gendered what I spoke about as being and the compensation of the law as feminine and masculine. And in Soloveitchik's work itself, when he speaks about the gendered mother or the gendered father, the archetypal father and archetypal mother, he speaks about the mother in terms of merging. It's a possibility of merging that Soloveitchik in his writing seems to both relish and also fear. That there's the desire for, or that longing for union, but also the sense or the fear of getting subsumed.
Because the sense of rupture is all throughout his work in terms of his discussion of Adam the First and Adam the Second, the dialectical approach that he takes to questions of wholeness and reunion with the divine, which are both at once to be desired and unattainable. Mm. So is his conception of rupture, I guess, I'm too drawn to two-part questions, so I'll break this up. The first question is his sense of rupture, how much of it is internal to the rabbinic hermeneutic, and how much of it emerges or changes after his removal from the world of his birth and after the Shoah?
I think for Soloveitchik, you talk about him, or my writing about him, as a lonely or melancholy figure. I mean, it's really Soloveitchik himself, as I'm sure your listeners know, who fashions himself as the lonely man of faith.
Right.
Part of the argument of my work is that when he proclaims on the first page of The Lonely Man of Faith, "I am lonely," it's a kind of mark of Cain, which he's taking for himself.
Wow.
It's a way really of identifying himself as an individual outside of the tradition of his fathers. Early on in his life, when he represents himself, there's a fascinating piece in the work from There Shall You Seek, in which Soloveitchik imagines himself as a young man in the study of his father. And he really imagines himself very much outside the gathering of students who are awaiting the interpretations of his father.
Right.
In those stories, loneliness is a mark of vulnerability, of being an outsider, of shame. By the 1960s, Soloveitchik has transformed that loneliness into a mark of existential authenticity, which really goes back to what I was saying earlier about Soloveitchik throughout his writings representing himself or representing his own progress. For Soloveitchik, tshuva, repentance, is such an important part of his philosophical discourses.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also important for Soloveitchik because it's for him the means of storytelling, rewriting, in more theological terms, rewriting one's past in order to gain atonement. But in personal terms, it was the way of Soloveitchik rewriting his own story. So that loneliness really shifts in his own register from being, again, that mark of vulnerability and shame to that mark of existential authenticity. And I think, again, the Briskers, his ancestors, Rav Chaim, his grandfather, Rav Elville, his uncle, are not of the same type. I mean, he later in his life tries to rewrite the story of his uncle Velvel in his own, according to his own lights, and sees him as an emotional figure. But that, by all accounts, does not seem to be characteristic of Velvel or the other figures of Brisk. I mean, it's really true that Soloveitchik rewrites almost all of the biblical figures who he encounters as lonely figures. So Moses is a lonely figure, Abraham is a lonely figure, Elisha is a lonely figure. For Soloveitchik, loneliness is just a, a major interpretive category.
So, and then back to the first part of my question. Sorry for interrupting, but that leads back to the first part of the question, which was how internal to the rabbinic hermeneutic that he, whose tradition he inherits, is the concept of rupture, and what does he do with that concept that is unique to him?
Well, I think, again, maybe to try to rearticulate what I was saying earlier, rabbinic pluralism is based upon the notion that any epistemological act is by definition going to be incomplete. Therefore, there's the imperative of machloket, of dispute. Mm-hmm. In my reading of the rabbinic tradition, I know there are other readings, dispute is not bidyavad. It's not something like after the fact that we have to somehow settle with. That is all there is. Hilary Putnam, the late Hilary Putnam, the Harvard philosopher, he said, adopting J.L. Austin, enough may not be everything, but enough is enough. And I think that really is a motto for rabbinic interpretation, that there is a, not so much a settling, but an acknowledgement of the limitation of interpretation. And that's therefore the necessity of Rava and Abaya, the necessity of having different perspectives on an interpretive issue. That is, once we lose that initial or original sense, I mean, the Talmud thematizes this kind of issue in its recountings of the death of Moses. Somehow, before the death of Moses, there was this whole or complete truth. After the death of Moses, we enter this realm of tradition, of Masara, of also multiplicity. And that realm of multiplicity is informed by, again, what I call this epistemological humility, or the sense that enough is enough. For Soloveitchik, as I was suggesting, and this is tied to what I was saying earlier about his need to be tied to being or to oneness, is enough really isn't enough. For Soloveitchik, the model of interpretation is not so much the model of these and these are the words of the living God, the idea that's thematized about dispute in the Talmud. But when he writes about interpretation, he writes about interpretation as conquest. Now, of course, in the early work, in Halachic Man, there is a kind of almost euphoric sense of conquest as being able to push off all of the existential problems of life.
Right.
That through conquest, one conquers death. Through conquest, one conquers mystery. That is interpretive conquest. Later in his life, he doesn't move away so far from the conception of interpretation as conquest, but he understands its limitations. So there is the famous, in his late work, movement both towards and back. That is, the halachic man, the interpreter, still, when he interprets, is a man who conquests, the subject conquering the object, but he afterwards has to withdraw and admit defeat. So where in the Talmud there's that acknowledgement of the necessity of different perspectives, for Soloveitchik there's always that triumphant moment of interpretation, but also then that movement back. So it really is, instead of enough is enough, it really is all or nothing. Either have it all, or there's that sense of existential despair in having nothing. I mean, more and more in Soloveitchik's later work, there is the sense that the purview of halacha has constrained, and there are less and less areas in which the halacha can claim to claim conquest.
Right.
But there still is that conception of rabbinic or Talmudic hermeneutics as one of conquest, of possession.
How internal to traditional rabbinic hermeneutics is his idea, which I think you discuss as coming later in his work, when he sort of argues against the subject-object distinction. And you have a lot of interesting things to say about this with respect to pluralism and polysemy and multiplicity in legal dispute. Can you talk about what he says about the subject-object distinction and receptions of that idea?
Well, I think what I haven't mentioned is that in Soloveitchik's work, there seems to be a gap, or again, another rupture, between his conception of Talmudic hermeneutics, that is legal interpretation, and the realm of the psyche, or a philosophical realm in which he really does cultivate a certain kind of pluralism. Readers of Soloveitchik, especially of halachic mind, will know that in trying to find a place for religious philosophy in a world in which science was triumphant, he argued for a certain kind of methodological pluralism. And as you suggest,
that methodological pluralism is informed by his desire to break down the subject-object distinction. Mm-hmm. He really saw science, especially in the early part of the 20th century, as embracing an older Newtonian conception of objectivity, which of course was also adopted by the social sciences,
right,
which I also think he objected to. Mm-hmm. Soloveitchik, not surprisingly, embraced the innovations of quantum scientists who in their own scientific work were really collapsing the distinction between subject and object, as what comes out of Niels Bohr's conception of complementarity, mm-hmm, is the idea that subjects help create the world that they see. And of course, this is, I mean, in a way, this is really the crux of my argument about Soloveitchik and the rabbis in general. It's a very hard argument to make in today's world, because as soon as you make a statement like I just did, people will claim, "Oh, well, that means you're just a relativist." And
right,
of course, it really, or to embrace the other side, that you just believe in objective truth as if such a thing could possibly exist.
Mm-hmm.
Soloveitchik understood, and he's really getting this understanding from Aristotle, that subjectivity and objectivity are really just points on a continuum. And it's through subjective perspectives that different parts of the object begin to emerge. He made this argument very, very powerfully in relationship to his discussions of methodological pluralism. What's interesting is that he does not make the same argument in relationship to rabbinic pluralism.
Huh.
That is, where pluralism is something to be celebrated in his philosophical discussions, the phrase again, "these and these are the words of the living God," which are probably celebrated in every major Jewish theologian of the 20th century, certainly the late 20th century,
right,
is really notably absent from Soloveitchik's work. He's really not so interested in pluralism, not as a theoretical concept. Maybe in practice, as some of his students will always point out, he obviously was a master of those Talmudic discourses.
Mm-hmm.
But when he theorizes those discourses, he's really not interested so much in pluralism.
Okay. And this leads to questions I have because he's such a unique thinker about, mm-hmm, and we've covered this a little bit, but I want to go back to the question of different receptions of his work. Mm-hmm. Some claim that there's a comprehensive unity to the work, and others assert that the embrace of paradox and ambiguity or ambivalence and the sense of loss makes him more of a Western philosopher than a rabbinic thinker. And there's even division within the modern Orthodox community, and I believe amongst the students who studied under him as to the unity of his thought. Can you address that a little bit in the book? And I wonder if you'd talk about that.
So let me give you a two-part answer then.
Mm-hmm.
I think as far as the reception of his students or Soloveitchik's work as received by his students, I think it's probably true of any complex thinker, and I'm thinking probably most of John Milton. There is a way in which the thinker accommodates himself or herself to multiplicity of different perspectives. Milton was notable for being both, in the eyes of his readers, an orthodox thinker, and as William Blake called him, of the devil's party without knowing it. And so Soloveitchik now is the poster boy for both a modern liberal orthodoxy, or liberal modern orthodoxy,
mm-hmm,
but also he is a figure, to me, unbelievably, of a kind of Haredi orthodoxy, that a Soloveitchik lends himself to different kinds of appropriations. Moving on to the other part of your question, the way in which people will use either the word paradox or ambivalence, or actually ambivalence is my word,
mm-hmm,
paradox or dialectic, in order to create a unity out of Soloveitchik's work, to me that's a form of apologetics. And I think there has been a kind of, I won't call it a failure of Soloveitchik scholarship, because it's really not fair to say such a thing. But most of Soloveitchik scholarship has been conducted by his students, and they're very much inside of the hermeneutic circle.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if it's to suggest that, you know, readers of Paradise Lost could only be 17th century Puritans. meanings of Paradise Lost really develop or become evident over the centuries or over the decades, uh-huh, over the ages. And I think that's the same thing that should be true of Soloveitchik. People have found Soloveitchik outside of this hermeneutic circle outside of his students to be passé or boring. And I think that's because we've reached a kind of impasse with his in his reception, that his students see him only as a Rebbe. And you've noted in the conversation we've been having, I refer to him sometimes as Rabbi Soloveitchik, but in my book I talk to him, to speak about him as Soloveitchik,
yeah,
which I think in a way dignifies him in giving him a place as a significant theologian and philosopher of the 20th century. That is to take him out of the provinces of Yeshiva University, in which he is kind of a Rebbe,
right,
and to open up his work to other languages, to other discourses. So I think, as you suggested in your introduction, I employ a kind of hermeneutics of empathy, meaning I have an obvious reverence for the Rav.
Yeah.
But there's also a hermeneutics of suspicion. And I said before that my word really is ambivalence, that there is an unarticulated sense of rupture in Soloveitchik's work. And for me, the language is a psychoanalysis and some literary criticism help unearth that and help give form to that ambivalence.
Interesting.
And I do think there's ambivalence in Soloveitchik's work, which those who say, well, the dialectic reigns over all of Soloveitchik's work, I think they're really unwilling to acknowledge that ambivalence.
Uh-huh. It's funny because one of the phrases that I was going to use with respect to your perspective on Soloveitchik is a hermeneutics of disillusionment. In fact, the very first words of your book are very evocative. You say this book began in disillusionment in the preface. Mm-hmm. You make compelling observations about subjectivity and objectivity as fussy remnants of an older scholarship. But when you say this book began in disillusionment, what do you mean, and what became of the disillusionment that the book began with?
Well, I think, as I said in the opening, my interest in Soloveitchik was at first motivated by this interest in pluralism. And I think that disillusion that I felt originally was seeing the way in which his own conceptions of pluralism were dictated his readings of religious philosophy, of the philosophical traditions of the West, of methodological issues that were urgent in the early part of the 20th century. But when it came to his own rabbinic tradition, he was not using or deploying that conception of pluralism at all.
Mm.
So I think as a self-acknowledged American liberal, I felt that sense of disappointment or disillusion.
Interesting.
in confronting what I understood after decades of reading Soloveitchik, the contradictions and maybe rupture of his work.
Uh-huh.
Having said that, I think that the book ends with really a note of optimism. That is, Soloveitchik, on the one hand, pushes off pluralism in a certain interpretive, that is, legal or hermeneutic realm, but he definitely puts forth a conception of pluralism in both his readings of the psyche and also in his ethics. I think the ethics that Soloveitchik develops in his later work, which really do emphasize plural agencies or different agencies,
mm-hmm,
encountering other or others, that's using Buber's language or Levinas's language,
yeah,
and also in his conception of the psyche, where he acknowledges multiple agencies, in many ways like Freud. And I think my Freudian reading of Soloveitchik, I think, is justified, because I think Freud was always, in some sense, on Soloveitchik's mind. I think he was trying to redeem the Jewish project a book was published called Family Redeemed, and I think it probably should have been titled Family Redeemed from Freud.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
But so, I think the book and the I was just going to say that I think the book ends, I hope, on a positive note, in incorporating that pluralism and trying to think of a future that would both incorporate the hermeneutics of mourning of the rabbis and also the pluralism that's implicit in Soloveitchik's ethics and conception of the psyche.
Right. And I think your book really sets an interesting new direction for the study of Soloveitchik's work, and I find it very interesting, and I'm wondering what new directions it's led your scholarship in and what you're working on next.
Well, one of the interesting things about Soloveitchik scholarship, and this is, I think, parallels what I was saying earlier about Soloveitchik being read and studied mostly by his students, is that there is a kind of monopoly over Soloveitchik texts, and every year or 2 years, a new collection of essays is published under Soloveitchik's name. Huh. There's a recent book called that just came out called Halachic Morality, again about Soloveitchik's ethics. Lawrence Kaplan, who translated Halachic Man, published earlier this year or last year, published a set of lecture notes, very detailed lecture notes, that were taken at Soloveitchik's lectures on Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed.
Right.
So for me, there are always new, there seem to be endless possibilities for new readings of Soloveitchik, or more complicated reads of Soloveitchik as his works get to be published.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on next?
Well, I've been flipping through the pages of Halachic Morality, mm-hmm. and seeing the ways in which Soloveitchik conceives of or expresses his conceptions of ethics, which I began to discuss in The Last Rabbi, and I'm hoping to be able to extend my argument or revise or qualify my argument in relationship to these newly published works.
Well, I greatly look forward to reading that book, as I enjoyed reading this one, and I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, thank you so much, David. I appreciate it.
Once again, the author is William Kohlbrenner, professor of English at Bar-Ilan University in Israel, and the book is The Last Rabbi, Joseph Soloveitchik and Talmudic Tradition, published by Indiana University Press. Professor Kohlbrenner, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.